From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, President Obama backs gay marriage, European voters shake it up, J.P. Morgan Chase shaken up, old bullying charges, a new Al-Qaeda bomb. The president sat down with ABC on Wednesday and moved past his once evolving stance on gay marriage.
It is important for me to go ahead and affirm that I think same-sex couples should be able to get married.
Big bad bets are back in the banking world. J.P. Morgan Chase raises bailout flashbacks with lost billions. CEO Jamie Dimon.
The new strategy was flawed, complex, poorly reviewed, poorly executed, and poorly monitored. The portfolio has proven to be riskier, more volatile, and less effective as an economic hedge than we thought.
And pushback at the polls for austerity leaders in Greece and France. Sarkozy's out. Socialist François Hollande, president-elect, with cheers. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Major Garrett of the National Journal, syndicated columnist Mona Charon, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? Gay marriage, Europe's votes, banking billions? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Major Garrett joins us from Washington, White House correspondent for the National Journal. Major, welcome back to On Point.
Hello, Tom.
Great to have you. Mona Charon is with us, also from Washington, syndicated columnist for the National Review and more. Mona, thanks very much for being here. Welcome back.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beattie joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Major, and Mona.
Let's go straight to gay marriage. Major Garrett, you started off this week with a column chastising President Obama and Mitt Romney for not stepping up on a couple of fronts, and you were pointing at Obama on the gay marriage front. Has he stepped up now, and what's it mean, Major?
Well, from the president's point of view, he has stepped up. The White House Press Secretary Jay Carney had a very difficult time on Monday because he had to endure about 22 minutes of sustained questioning on the question of whether or not the president would, in fact, endorse gay marriage sometime this week or in the near future.
After the vice president had done it seemingly off the
yes.
cuff, I don't know.
It didn't feel or look to me off the cuff,
okay.
And I don't believe it was off the cuff. I'm not sure it was entirely elaborately orchestrated, but it did follow a nice consecutive order for the president. And yesterday it was reported the vice president apologized. I can't imagine what he apologized for. This has all worked out magnificently well for the president. He dominated the headlines on an issue that is not the economy for 4 days. That's good for the Chicago reelection headquarters of Obama. It's bad for the Boston They would hope election headquarters of Mitt Romney. So in the main, the president took a position that not only put him on the forefront of this issue, still leaving it to the states, which did not in every single way please those in the gay community, but he has completely rounded out his administration's record on gay issues. And as Jonathan Rauch, a colleague of mine here at National Journal, wrote today, that may be his greatest legacy of his presidency, because without a doubt he has done more on gay rights issues than any president before him. And half of that work has been to undo the work done by a previous Democratic president, Bill Clinton. Don't ask, don't tell,
right.
And the Defense of Marriage Act.
Mona Charon, do you see it as a win for the president, a problem for Mitt Romney in terms of electoral politics? After all, North Carolina voted on Tuesday, and yet again, what is it, 30, 31 states now? No, right in the Constitution in North Carolina to gay marriage.
Yes, it's very hard to evaluate how this will play politically because, well, for one thing, let's just look at the assumption that we hear a lot that, you know, this issue is widely popular in the country, that majorities say that they are now in favor of gay marriage, which is a change from the recent past.
Big change.
Yeah, it is. But at the same time, if you look at that's what people say to pollsters. And yet, as you point out, 32 states or more than 30 states have now passed constitutional amendments or changed their laws so that gay marriage would not be acceptable. So seems to be a little bit of a disconnect between what people say to pollsters and how they actually vote when they get inside the voting booth. As far as whether it gives the president any benefit, you know, Major's right. Anytime you can change the subject off the economy, it's a good day for the president. But it's hard to imagine that anybody is going to vote for him now because he has finally come clean about his true position on gay marriage. By the way, you know, he was for gay marriage in 1996. He then flipped to being against it when he wanted to run for the Senate in 2004 and maintained that position in the presidency until now, where he's slipping back. But it's hard to see that anybody is going to vote for him now who wasn't already planning on voting for him. So I don't think that the electoral consequences are clear. You know, some people say, well, the evangelicals will now be more enthusiastic toward Romney than perhaps they were before. I don't really buy that either. So I actually think that that in terms of the electoral or the political effects, it's probably a wash.
You know, Jack, I want to come to you on exactly what the president has given the country here. The headlines were, you know, along the lines of president endorses gay marriage, and indeed he did. But in terms of implementation, he's leaving a lot to the states. Here he is from that Wednesday interview with ABC's Good Morning America host Robin Roberts here, and about saying how it's up to state governments how to actually go forward.
I continue to believe that this is an issue that is going to be worked out at the local level, because historically this has not been a federal issue.
But Mr. President, it's not being worked out on the state level. We saw that Tuesday in North Carolina, the 30th state to, in essence, ban
What I'm saying is that different states are coming to different conclusions.
Well, it is being worked out at the local level in North Carolina, Jack. It's just not going the way maybe that interviewer suggested that, you know, it ought to in working out. But what about the president endorsing? Yes, but saying it's up to each state? That takes us back to kind of states' rights. If this is a civil rights issue, what does that implementation position mean?
Well, I think it really means that everything is up to Anthony Kennedy. The court decision will nationalize this eventually, one way or another. You know, I think the president was operating on a version of Harry Truman's comment. He said, when in doubt, do right. And he really followed that advice. He did write historically. The Washington Post's Karen Tumulty, speaking yesterday on the show, said she's talked to evangelical preachers who say that when they look out at the young people in their pews, they sense that gay marriage is a question of when, not if. The president did right personally. As Mona says, he was for gay rights before he was against it. And he was right on the money. Reports on Monday said gay and progressive donors were angry at him. Reports on Tuesday said they were ecstatic. Mm-hmm. Was it right politically? I really think that I agree with the others. It remains to be seen. For now, it looks like it's not only helped the president with his progressive base, but perhaps Mitt Romney with his conservative base.
Major Garrett, you put the president on gay marriage this week. Before he came out with this statement in support, you put his evolving kind of lack of clarity on that in the same as a pea in the pod with Mitt Romney on this interesting moment. This was in Cleveland, Ohio on Monday at a Romney campaign rally when a woman stood up in the audience and Romney acknowledged her. And then she gave this little speech where she talks about the president saying he should, President Obama should be tried for treason. And then, Mitt Romney had essentially no response in that setting. Here's the woman first.
We have a president right now that is operating outside the structure of our Constitution. And I do agree he should be tried for treason.
He should be tried for treason. Now, Romney went on to praise the Constitution, but in that setting, he said a little bit later on a rope line, but in that setting, he said nothing about that. And Major, what was your gripe there?
Well, my only statement about both of these episodes was that they were tactically understood or understandable, but lacked essential political courage. Now, the president changed his position on gay marriage, so for those who have advocated for that position, they would now see him acting as courageously. But I wrote this on Monday before that was clear, and after a tortured day at the White House of no answer and no movement. But for Romney, the tactics of that is, look, this campaign does not want to get in the habit of refereeing ideologically or by tenor of rudeness or politeness town hall meetings. Mitt Romney does very few press availabilities with his traveling press corps. The town hall scenario is the closest thing the campaign will let reporters see or voters get to genuine interaction with Romney. And he knows if he gets into the business of fly-specking every question and sort of putting on a rude measurement, like, well, that's out of bounds or this is in bounds, he's going to see these things devolve and he's going to lose control of them. Plus, he fears Democrats will cleverly place themselves in these events and trip Romney up endlessly with provocative statements.
But so, in your piece, Major, you're holding him to task on the courage metric here and saying,
yes,
wait a minute. I mean, look, just for comparison here from 08, this is the famous—
I'm not defending. I'm just saying that's the tactical approach the Romney campaign takes. But I think every time he doesn't do that, he reminds people that he's simply not willing at all or We haven't found that place where he's willing enough to say to conservative voters, look, some things are unacceptable. Some things are out of bounds, and I disagree with you.
It has been done. If I may, Major, we got a break coming, but in 08, this was the John McCain campaign rally. This was in Lakeville, Minnesota. And McCain, candidate then for president, was quick to push back when one attendee called then candidate Obama an Arab.
I can't trust Obama. I have read about him, and he's an Arab. He is not.
No, ma'am. He's a decent family man, citizen that I just happen to have disagreements with on fundamental issues, and that's what this campaign is all about. He's not. Thank you.
John McCain, 2008. Major Garrett, are you saying Mitt Romney should have said something like that right here where this call for trial for treason came this week from Mitt Romney?
What I'm saying is voters will look at those two, contrast them instantly in their memory, or be reminded of the contrast and draw their own conclusions. I think Romney is at times hurting himself by this excessive caution with Republican audiences because he has to define himself, and he's already defined himself largely as being a hyper-cautious politician. This just reinforces that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news this hour. The president on gay marriage, big votes shaking Europe. J.P. Morgan Chase shaking itself with a couple of $1 billion lost in a hurry and the whole banking industry looking at that. Mitt Romney in an old bullying charge comeback. Mona Charon is with us. Syndicated columnist joins us today from Washington. Major Garrett, White House correspondent for the National Journal as well. And our own Jack Beatty. Primary in Indiana this week, and the Tea Party candidate, Mr. Murdoch, took it away from longtime Indiana Senator Richard Lugar. Richard Murdoch will run against a Democrat for the position in the fall. Here was Lugar, known for reaching across the aisle. He made an argument in his concession speech for the virtues of bipartisanship.
We are experiencing deep political divisions in our society right now. And these divisions have stalemated progress in critical areas. But these divisions are not insurmountable. And I believe that people of goodwill, regardless of party, can work together for the benefit of our country.
Richard Lugar, he's got cheers there, but he's out. And his Tea Party-backed opponent, Richard Murdoch, sort of running away with it. 6 terms, and he's done. Mona Charon, how do you interpret what happened with Richard Lugar, Senator Lugar?
Lugar had been around for 6 terms. That's a really long time to serve in any job, including in the United States Senate. Murdoch is a very credible challenger. He's somebody who has won statewide office. He's had a good career. He is not some, you know, sort of tossed-up, inexperienced Tea Party candidate such as Christine O'Donnell or Sharon Angle, as we saw in the last election cycle. This is a substantive guy, and the voters in Indiana were ready for a change. Now, everybody is interpreting, not everybody, but many are saying that, you know, this proves that the Republican Party is intolerant and so forth. You know, when Joe Lieberman lost a Democratic primary, I don't recall people saying this was evidence that the Democratic Party was intolerant of people who were willing to reach across the aisle and so on and so forth. You know, people, the Democrats in Connecticut wanted a more left-wing candidate, and Republicans in Indiana wanted a more conservative candidate. That's pretty much it.
Major, what do you see this signaling to other senators and their races and their positions?
Well, it's a mixed bag. There is one angle that this is bad for incumbents. Well, whenever an incumbent loses, people get in Washington who have incumbent status get a little nervous. But look, incumbents have been winning pretty consistently on the House side in various primaries. There have been Tea Party-backed Republican challengers who largely this year have been unsuccessful. Orrin Hatch, very similarly situated as Senator Lugar was as far as seniority, survived and prevailed in a convention in Utah. He's got a runoff. He's likely to win that. He ran an aggressive campaign, got ahead of it, understood that he was in jeopardy. Richard Lugar did not. And Richard Lugar had a one core problem he could never get behind, which is a residency issue. He didn't live in Indiana. He had a sort of a make-believe Indiana presence as far as his residence. Well, that was a toxic combination. Long-term service, a little bit too much collaboration with President Obama on a couple of issues, not very many. He was pretty much down the line on conservative issues, but not universally so. But he'd been around a long time. He had lost touch with his state. And this residency issue, he simply never fully addressed. And he ran a lackluster campaign until the last couple of weeks, where Richard Murdoch ran an aggressive, focused, hyper-intensive campaign for many months. And in politics, conversations like that are competitive. Sometimes you lose.
Long time in the Senate, famous for reaching across the aisle. A lot of money poured in here. But yeah, maybe it was just too long. Jack, what do you see in the Lugar story?
Well, you know, when he entered the Senate in 1977, he was ranked the 16th most conservative of 38 Republicans. And in the last Congress, he was rated 7th most liberal Republican. His positions didn't change over the years. His party did. In today's GOP, it's not enough to be against Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the stimulus, Obamacare, and Dodd-Frank. Not enough if you voted for President Obama's Supreme Court nominees and are considered a voice of bipartisan compromise. Lugar's comment on the man who defeated him, Treasurer Murdoch, really is resonant. Murdoch, quote, stands for reflexive votes and rigid opposition to the actions and proposals of the other party. He has pledged his support to groups whose prime mission is to cleanse the Republican Party of those who stray from orthodoxy as they see it. You know, that description of that tendency in the GOP really echoes the findings of Mann and Ornstein, that the party in Congress, not the party in the electorate necessarily, but the party in Congress is the most uncompromisingly conservative in a century. They write, when one party moves this far from the mainstream, it makes it nearly impossible for the political system to deal constructively with the country's challenges.
Tom?
Mona, please. Orthodoxy killing us here, making it impossible to work? Or what do you see, Mona?
Well, I mean, I would just point to something. When he was in his desperate last hours in this campaign, Senator Lugar ran a television commercial that was pure Metascare. It was right out of the Democratic Party's playbook, saying that if voters chose Murdoch, they would be choosing to see their Medicare taken away from them and so forth. And, you know, that ad, as much as anything, illustrated that Lugar had changed and had begun to embrace the politics of the Democrats.
What about the argument that the whole party sort of left him behind?
Well, you know, this is a repeated argument. I've heard it now every election cycle of my adult life, that, you know, we long for the good old days when the Republican Party was not so rigid and ideological. I actually think the Democratic Party is highly rigid and ideological as well. I think that both parties have their views, and it's not fair to constantly say that the Republicans, who have their principles, they want smaller government, they want, you know, less regulation, they want freer American people, we don't want to go bankrupt the way Europe is. You know, these positions are always sort of tarred as ideological, whereas the Democrats, who want bigger government and a more intrusive state, that's seen as sort of being the moderate center.
I want to go to
ask the two centrist Democrats in Pennsylvania who did lose House races, competitive House races, due to redistricting this year. They lost two union-backed, more left-of-center nominees from the Democratic Party. They would also say possibly that they have been thrust out of the party because they were too willing to either not always vote with Nancy Pelosi or Barack Obama, maybe side with Republicans. So it is not as if you were going to call it cleansing, and I'm not even sure I'm comfortable with that terminology, because, look, voters make decisions based on their own interpreted interests, but centrist Democrats, are the very few incumbents who have lost this year, on the Democratic side, it's been centrist Democrats who've lost, not left-of-center Democrats.
Can we go to a back-and-forth between Mitt Romney and Barack Obama this week? And it was over the auto industry. The Obama administration has been very happy to see that come back after all the intervention that was there. This week, Mitt Romney raised some eyebrows when he said on Monday at an auto manufacturing plant in Cleveland, he claimed a lot of credit for the revival of Detroit's auto industry.
Well, my own view, by the way, was that the auto companies needed to go through bankruptcy before government help. And frankly, that's finally what the president did. He finally took them through bankruptcy. That was the right course I argued for from the very beginning. It was the UAW and the president that delayed the idea of bankruptcy. I pushed the idea of a managed bankruptcy. And finally, when that was done and help was given, the companies got back on their feet. So I'll take a lot of credit for the fact that that this industry's come back.
He'll take a lot of credit. There was skepticism about that, first and foremost, from the president himself on Wednesday talking with ABC. Here was the president.
Well, you know, I think this is one of his etch-a-sketch moments.
I don't think anybody takes that seriously. People remember his position, which was, let's let Detroit go bankrupt. So had we followed his advice at that time, GM and Chrysler would have gone under, and we would have lost probably 1 million jobs throughout the Midwest.
So you've got people saying without the $81 billion in bailout, the companies would have been forced to go out of business and liquidate. But here's Mitt Romney saying, hey, I'll take not just some, but credit for that, Major. Fair or not?
Well, it's tactical, but it's not true. And what I mean by that is Mitt Romney knows he cannot afford to just give up on this argument. He's got to put his forward his idea of what he said and what it meant at the time, because if he doesn't, he's going to cede all of Michigan and big swaths of Ohio to the president, because if he gives up on the auto bailout question, the president's going to win that issue and win it decisively. Now, that's the tactical side. So he thinks, I just better engage this debate and be aggressive with my position. Okay, that's the tactics.
Yeah.
But is it truthful? No, it's not. His position in 2008 was, before President Bush, remember, this was set in motion by President Bush.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a great ideological leap for that free market Republican conservative yep. president. And while the president was debating that, Mitt Romney said, let them go through bankruptcy and let them find private equity financing as the bridge while that managed bankruptcy is going on. And everyone around that issue at the time says that simply did not exist. That absent an intervention of the federal government and federal tax dollars as a bridge financing mechanism, you couldn't go through the managed bankruptcy and extract from the unions and other stakeholders the necessary concessions to bring Chrysler and GM out on the other side of that managed bankruptcy process. That is the arc of the story writ small. There are lots of other details I've left out, but that's the essence of it. And Mitt Romney's right to say he did call for managed bankruptcy. That's true. A managed bankruptcy did happen. But there was a great intervening event, which was taxpayer dollars, and those around at the time said, absent those dollars, you can't get to a managed bankruptcy.
Let's go to our listeners. Mark in Acton, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. And by the way, thanks to Major Garrett. That was an excellent explanation of Mitt's propensity to lie because he thinks it's to his political advantage.
Well.
Which brings me to today's story about the bullying episode in the Washington Post and why it relates to today. It's not that it happened 48 years ago. It's that it shows that his character has not improved in all that time. Every classmate that was interviewed for this describes it as a haunting memory, a black mark on my character.
This is the incident where half a dozen young students reportedly led by Mitt Romney what sort of ran down another student, held him down, cut his hair. He was kind of a out-of-the-mainstream kid, later learned to be gay. Romney was the one wielding the scissors, and you've got in the Washington Post, they ran a big piece on this with other members of the group who did it, saying it was vicious, they were ashamed, and so on. Romney saying he doesn't remember.
Yeah, exactly. And my point is, I mean, these people described it as Lord of the Flies behavior and have been haunted by it for their whole lives. Romney says he doesn't remember, and the least troubling aspect of that is that he might be lying. If he's not lying, then it really is troubling, because it means that all these other people who've been haunted by this brutal attack for their entire lives have regretted it. But he just doesn't even remember it. It didn't even make a dent. And that would be because he lacks empathy. And that's what we've seen throughout this campaign. He likes to fire people. He is dismissive of the social safety net. He doesn't go around cutting people's hair. He goes around cutting the safety net.
Mark, we've got it. We've got the perspective pretty clear. I'll take it to our panel. Let me get a couple more listeners on it, if I may. Barbara, Boxford, Massachusetts. Barbara, you're on the air.
Hello. My point on this incident is that either he is lying, that he doesn't remember it, or that he engaged in so many bullying incidents that he doesn't remember this particular one. And either way, that says something disturbing about his character.
Wow, 1965, back in the race right there. Let's hear from Romney himself. Here he was with Brian Kilmeade. This is on Fox News Radio on Thursday. And he responded to this big Washington Post story about his years at the Cranbrook School, elite school in Michigan, where his father had been governor, of course, where he allegedly bullied other students, another student.
I'm not going to be too concerned about their piece. They talk about the fact that I played a lot of pranks in high school, and they describe some that well, you just say to yourself that back in high school, you know, I did some dumb things, and if anybody was hurt by that or offended, why, obviously I apologize. But overall high school years for a long time ago, and I'm glad I've got some good friends in those years.
Long time ago, he apologizes if anybody was hurt. Mona Chern, what do you make of this whole story?
Well, okay, so imagine that the shoe were on the other foot, and it was the Wall Street Journal running a huge front page story about Barack Obama's youthful indiscretions, his use of crack cocaine, which he talks about in Dreams from My Father, or this passage from that book where he talks about his own bullying of a fellow black student whose name was Coretta. I ran up to Coretta and gave her a slight shove. She staggered back and looked up at me, but I still said nothing. Leave me alone, I shouted again, and suddenly Coretta was running faster and faster until she disappeared from sight. Appreciative laughs rose around me. Then the bell rang. Now, that's from Dreams from My Father. Now, there are a lot of really, really partisan Republicans out there.
Is that the same as holding a kid down and whacking his hair off while he screams and cries? I don't know.
You know what? We have all done things as children and as adolescents that I think we regret. And the notion that this somehow is indicative of Romney's character and therefore he shouldn't be president of the United States is such an overreach. I cannot really imagine that people are taking it so seriously.
Yeah, I hear you. Brad in Buffalo, New York. Brad, you're on the air. What do you think? It's a long time ago, but people care about character. Does this count?
Hello. Yes, it does. I remember several campaigns ago when John Kerry was running, and John Kerry's actions in Vietnam and his post-Vietnam protests of that war were a very major thing, and people were going back into the record of the 1960s and saying, oh, that dastardly John Kerry, he's become a traitor. And it was important that he was swift-voted, essentially, and some people believe, out of the presidency because of his, because of the actions of people that swift-voted him.
Yeah, it's fair and true. That came back then, and here's this now. So you're saying maybe it's not so strange. Forgive me, Brad, but I want to get Jack in here before we get to the break. Jack, what do you make of all this?
Well, you know, none of us would like to have our behavior in high school recalled. I mean, and it isn't necessarily prologue to our adult characters. I just don't accept that. On the other hand, what we see here is how rigid Mr. Romney is. He could have just admitted, yeah, of course I remember this, and I'm ashamed of it, as lots of people are ashamed of things they did, and gone on. Instead, he made it a credibility issue. So it raises the empathy issue for many people, but clearly for almost any fair-minded person, there's a credibility issue. If these five other people, or however many it were, remembered, if it's graven on their minds because they're ashamed of it, surely he does too.
It is kind of hard to imagine forgetting something like that. These other guys do seem like pretty credible gents, and they don't have any shadiness about it, any fogginess about it at all. Why would Mitt?
Some of the people who were interviewed, the family of the student who was the supposed victim of this episode, have complained about the Post piece and said that their brother would not, who has since passed away, would not have wanted this to be reported that way, that they did not like the way it was reported. They felt that it was misleading. So
that's different than not remembering. I mean, you've got people saying that they're haunted by it for their whole lives. And
all of the people who said they were haunted by it, the Post article admits, are liberal-leaning, Democrat-leaning people. They may have had an agenda.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, in ancient Olympia, the countdown to the Summer Olympics began with the lighting of the flame that will burn at the London Games. The great Maurice Sendak, children's writer extraordinaire, died Tuesday at 83. Here he reads from his best-known book, Where the Wild Things Are.
They roar their terrible roars and gnash their terrible teeth and roll their terrible eyes and showed their terrible claws. Kilmac said, "Be still!"
And music fans mourned the loss of Adam Yauch, MCA of the Beastie Boys, of cancer. He was 47. You can hear our full interview with Adam Yauch from 2008 at our website, onpointradio.org. We're looking at a big week in the news with Major Garrett of the National Journal. Mona Charon is with us, syndicated columnist. And our own Jack Beatty. You know, also, Jack, news this week from Rutgers report that only 51% of all college grads since 2006 now have a full-time job. I mean, it is graduation season. I'm giving a commencement address tomorrow at Niagara University in the shoes of Tim Russert and Mother Teresa, no less. They're north of Buffalo. But it's got me really thinking about what these bright young grads are up against in the job market. I mean, we wish them well, but it has been a tough patch to get started in, Jack, and remains so.
Yes, NPR has been doing a series on Morning Edition on this, and it's just, you know, these young people are told from day one, get a college degree and you'll prosper in life. And the statistics say that has been true. The question is, does it continue to be true? And when they you know, enter onto life and they not only can't find a job, but are saddled with exorbitant debt for getting to that process, it really sets them back, as some people think, decades. That is, there'll be a long, long time finding the right job, a job with sufficient income to begin to pay off what they had to pay out in order to get there.
But it is graduation season all over this country, and we wish the very best to all those heading out there. You know, good luck. Right up at the top of the finance world, we've got Jamie Dimon, just in the past 24 hours, the CEO of JPMorgan Chase. News broke that there was a $2 billion trading loss in just a very short period of time. He came out in a conference call with analysts and said there was no excuse for the loss.
Well, we can't assure you that we won't make mistakes. We can assure you we're going to try not to. These were egregious mistakes. They were self-inflicted. We were accountable. And what happened violates our own standards and principles by how we want to operate the company. This is not how we want to run a business.
Egregious mistakes, self-inflicted, we're accountable, well, but Major Garrett, it's easy to start to feel bailout queasiness again there when a big bank is again doing these credit default swaps, synthetic debt is the problem, and billions lost in the blink of an eye, and it makes everybody nervous.
Credit default swaps, derivative trades, and other transactions that J.P. Morgan thought would work, did not work. Now, everyone understands there is risk involved in investing, but the opaque world of derivatives trading, credit default swaps, other increasingly complicated financial instruments are making it more risky for these large, institutionally significant-sized banks, and that is happening at a time when Washington is trying to impose the regulations written into the Dodd-Frank regulation law. Republicans in Congress are fighting that process. The banks are fighting that process. And there is a great concern that J.P. Morgan and its losses are not fully disclosed. There could be another $1 billion in losses they have yet to admit and be transparent about, and that other banks also invested similarly or tried to use these gizmos, if you will, in the financing world, and those may have come a cropper as well. And we may be in a situation, and I don't want to say something that hasn't been disclosed or that I have any special information, but there's fear in the financial markets that other shoes may drop. And if we get in the other shoes may drop sequence, people are going to get very nervous about positions for banks in the United States, positions in banks globally, and there's already enough worry and trepidation about what the banking situation, the bond markets are doing and saying in Europe. It will be a very difficult and uneasy and somewhat volatile environment for the next couple of months.
Mona Charon, lots of trepidation in the markets already around this, and as Congress still looks at the Volcker Rule and all the rest, saying banks shouldn't make bets with their own money here. You had Carl Levin coming out, Democrat, Michigan, and saying this enormous loss announced today by J.P. Morgan, just the latest evidence that what banks call hedges are often risky bets that so-called too-big-to-fail banks have no business making. And he says it's a stark reminder of the need for regulators to establish tough, effective standards. Jamie Dimon says no. How do you see it, Mona?
I think that what we are seeing is very much a consequence of the government's willingness to go in and bail out banks when they have made bad bets. Because what we've done is we've created this terrible moral hazard problem where, you know, you can make these bets, and if you're right, you privately get the profit, but if you're wrong, the taxpayers get the loss. And, you know, until we fix that problem, until we finally wrap our minds around the idea that, you know, private entities should truly be private and they should be allowed to suffer losses when they make bad decisions, we're just going to get more and more of this. And it's just an outrage that taxpayers should be left bailing out banks who make bad decisions.
But George Bush brought us that bailout, and he did it against, I'm sure, a lot of instincts, because if they hadn't gone in, there was a risk of everything melting down that they were so attuned to. So why not regulate up front so we're not in this situation?
You know, if you look closely at the Dodd-Frank legislation that is a product of the Democrats in Congress and this Democratic president, it basically institutionalizes too big to fail. It makes it, it allows government the power to continue this practice of providing soft landings, and it's an entrenched problem. And I agree with you that both parties bear responsibility for it.
Jack, pull away the backstop so it all can come crashing down, or get in there up front, as this country did for many years, and say, let's separate the big bets from your bank money here.
Well, you know, I half agree with Mona. I was with the Senate liberals, frankly, who I think had the right of it when I think there are only 23 of them who voted to break up these big banks. And their argument, and the argument of Simon Johnson, the economist, was if they're too big to fail, they're too big to exist. And that there was no mileage in allowing these huge entities, which just through the crisis grew even huger, to continue to imperil the world economy by their sheer size and by the carelessness and the opacity, as Major said, that's built into them. So, yes, there is moral hazard, I think, just baked in the cake.
And the market's shaking plenty in response to this. Here's a listener in Vermont, BHA, says he wants to know, how much does Jamie Dimon make? Why does he still have a job? He knew about these complicated credit default swaps. He says, I don't care how much he chastises himself publicly. If he were a true leader, he would clean up the bank, not continue with potentially dangerous investing practices. Well, how do we motivate that kind of behavior? Stanley in Reading, Vermont. Stanley, you're on the air.
Hello. Yes, I agree with the lady that had mentioned that the banks must have accountability, and they can't just win, and if they lose, to put that burden on the taxpayer. We've already done that once. We don't have to go down that road again.
But Stanley, if we give them the rope so that they can do that, and then the whole economic system, we're told globally, is in mortal danger, aren't we right back in the Bush administration's final week's dilemma?
Well, that's true, but we have to find a way of readjusting and recalibrating the regulations so that the banks can't do that. Whether it's a bank in this country or the European banks, I mean, they're all held responsible for what.
And Tom, if I might,
Mona,
you know, I think with the banks and also with the large auto companies, with any of these entities that are deemed too big to fail, really what can happen is, they do go through formal bankruptcy, and in the process of bankruptcy, we've seen the airlines do it on a regular basis. They don't go out of business altogether, or if they, sometimes they get loans and they're allowed to keep functioning for a while as they restructure. But in the case of where they did truly go out of business, it wouldn't mean that every single person who was employed in a bank and every single person who was employed by a car company would then be out of a job, because smaller companies would come in and buy up the profitable parts of the entity that's failing. And you'd have a redistribution of the assets, and things would move forward.
You know, Mona, I get that, but if you're talking banks and the global financial system, and the whole reason that we had the bailout was they said everything could come down, we could have a major depression for years and years.
That's,
I mean, Paul Volcker's no wild-eyed guy, and he says we need this. We had this kind of regulation before in this country.
Well, you know, there was a lot of scare talk, and it's not clear to me, looking back, that was actually true.
Well, hindsight. Let's hear from our listeners.
Yeah.
Chris in Buffalo. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
As a small business owner, I want to say that this is legalized gambling, and the economy is actually not so complex. It's built on an exchange of products. You have a product, you exchange it, you do a good job exchanging it, and there you go. And so when I hear complex financial instruments, I look at it's a place for people to hide criminal activity, which is no exchange of product for no compensation. It's just no exchange of product. So the thing is that, yes, it needs to be regulated. because it's criminal. It's just absolutely criminal. And you know what? If we do ourselves in, it's because we actually let people do it.
Well, I don't know if that is technically criminal, but it sure doesn't feel good when it gets bad. And Jeff, we've got Jamie Dimon not feeling so great right now about it. Omaha, Nebraska. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just feel that the Morgan Company is a large company, and in my opinion, if an institution is too big to fail, then it probably shouldn't exist in the beginning. It probably got there through corrupt means, and I don't think this is anything different than what they've done in the past. I guess my point was, if I understand history, if I've read correctly, that they were responsible or partly responsible for the first depression in the early 1900s when they put out false articles in the newspaper and caused many banks to fail, and then initially bought up the banks after they went through bankruptcy. I don't think they've changed their practices, and in my opinion, again, if that's the point that it's come to, well, then they probably...
Jeff, I think we've got that issue of too big to fail that a lot of people have talked about, and still we've got very big banks in this country. Our time is short, and I want to turn to Europe. We had big votes in France, where Sarkozy is out. The socialist candidate François Hollande is in Greece, where the major parties who had led during this period of real kind of chaos there, well, they're in a real kind of disarray at the moment. Germany, the big economy in Europe, and the pro-austerity chancellor there, Angela Merkel, reiterated on Wednesday the need for the EU countries that have signed the fiscal pact to hold things together to stay on track for budget discipline. She said, here's her in English.
Everyone must stick to the things we have agreed. 25 countries have already signed the fiscal pact. Congratulations to Slovenia, Greece, and Portugal, who have already ratified the pact. Ireland will organize a referendum on May 31st.
Stay on track with the austerity, says the German chancellor there. On Sunday night in Toul, France's hometown, the anti-austerity socialist president-elect Hollande made his stance on looming budgetary issues a highlight of his acceptance speech, interpreted here by France 24 News to English.
We need to give Europe a dimension of growth for employment and prosperity. And this is what I will say as soon as possible to our European partners, starting with Germany.
Major Garrett, look across the pond. What just happened in Europe?
Well, there's been considerable voting against austerity in the streets of Europe because Europeans don't like what austerity is doing to them individually, and they don't believe it's going to help their countries writ large or the European Union. And I think the central tension here is between Germany and the financing mechanism for the European Central Bank, which is largely German-backed banks. Mm. The bondholders there are looking across Europe and saying, we have a strong economy, you have weak economies, austerity works for us, it better work for you, you signed a pact. Why was that pact signed in the first place? To give the bondholders a sense that debt would be under control, at least in some point in the foreseeable future. Mm-hmm. Well, if debt isn't controlled in the foreseeable future, bondholders are going to flee. And when bondholders start to flee, it doesn't matter what voters vote on, okay? If the bonding mechanism that finances debt in Greece, Spain, Portugal flees, guess what? You have to print your own money, you have to get out of the euro, and you have to live on your own. And that's going to be a scary place. And the Germans are saying it will be a scarier place for you, Greece, Portugal, Spain, Ireland, fill in the blank, than what you feel now. The voters don't agree, and they're willing to risk that scarier future to try to stop what's happening to them right now. That's how it seems to me.
Mona, of course, their growth is going nowhere too, though, and their fiscal balances are all out of whack, even with the austerity. Maybe voters see that as well.
Well, I agree with Major's analysis of the situation. I would add that it is really a lesson for us, right? Because what we're seeing is the result of populations that have been told over many years by their governments that they could have more and more government benefits and put off the price to some other day and rack up debt. And Greece now is facing bankruptcy. Because, as Margaret Thatcher famously said, the trouble with socialism is that eventually you run out of other people's money. The money that the Greeks are hoping to rely on is that of German workers who work much longer hours, who retire at much older ages, who don't have 4 weeks of paid vacation, et cetera, every year. And it is really a frightening prospect. What's
German
happening.
Workers have pretty darn good paid vacation. I can tell you that much. Well, but they
work harder than other Europeans. And what's really frightening about the election results is that 70% of the voters in Greece gave their votes to far left or far right parties, to extremists, and one of them is a extreme left wing party with Maoist elements, and that one of them is an extreme right wing party whose symbol looks very much like a swastika.
In Greece, yeah, the Dawn Party there. Jack, what do you see? Just 20 seconds here. What do you see in Europe, Jack? What's the message?
I think it was given by the economist Herb Stein, who said, "What can't continue won't continue." And
but are we talking about social welfare or austerity?
Austerity.
Or both?
Austerity. I just don't see how you can keep it going.
What, tourniquet on things? You got to let the blood flow. Hollande says he'll try and do that. Socialist, yes, but the word is that he's likely to try and work with Angela Merkel. We'll see how that goes. Mona Charon, great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Major Garrett at National Journal. Thank you, Major.
Thank you.
Jack Beattie, thanks as always.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.